Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Later in the hour, I'll be talking to Sir Ken Robinson, who was recently in Lackson Auditorium talking about creativity in schools. My guest today is a psychotherapist and assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School and a former Jesuit. Robert Weber graduated with honors from Princeton, completed a master's degree at Harvard. He lived, worked, and trained as a Jesuit for almost 10 years before deciding to leave the order. He went on to earn a PhD in clinical psychology at Temple University in Philadelphia and launched a career as a psychologist in the 1980s. He is co-author of The Spirituality of Age, A Seeker's Guide to Growing Older. In this book, Robert Weber and his co-author Carol Orsborn guide us through 25 key questions, provide their own honest answers, and share their stories. Robert Weber, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you write in your book that you became a psychologist, quote, over your father's dead body.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, I had completed my degree. I was living in Boston, and at the time had already completed a pre-doc internship and was in the midst of a postdoc at Massachusetts General Hospital. And 1 year after you complete your degree, if you've acquired enough clinical hours, you're allowed to sit for the licensing exam. At the time, it was only given twice a year. So I had signed up for it, and it was in April of 1984, again, 1 year after I completed my degree. And the day before my exam, my sister calls and says, Bob, I said, yeah, Jerry, Dad's dead. I said, what? He had died of a heart attack. Now, I had to make a choice at that juncture. You know, should I run down immediately to New Jersey because I was in Cambridge, Mass., and were we going to drive right down that day? And I had to decide because the exam was only given twice a year at that juncture. So, you know, I had to start making a living. I had been a Jesuit for 10 years and not earning much, and a grad student and not earning much. And so I had to start getting earnings. So I had to make a hard choice. I talked with a number of friends and mentors and came up with the decision to sit for the exam. I was a zombie during the exam. It turns out I did pass it. We flew down to New Jersey on, of all things, Ransom Airlines out of Worcester, Mass. And then I joined my sister and brother, and we made arrangements for my father's funeral. So it was, you know, I was becoming a psychologist, literally, you know, at the time of my father's death. That's why I talked about it that way. And it was quite a powerful moment. Sad, happy, a whole slew of things. But again, my moving on to be a licensed psychologist occurred amidst really very painful circumstances.
Well, usually when somebody uses the expression over my dead body or somebody's dead body, they're speaking metaphorically. But this was rather literally that you became a psychologist over. And usually what somebody means by that is that there's a little disagreement and your father did not want you to become a psychologist. He wanted you to be a priest.
He absolutely wanted me to be a priest. I was groomed in the late 40s and 50s within a Catholic family. And the church for me was a very important part of my life. I felt very much at home in the church. I felt at home in the mornings when I would serve as an altar boy. And I felt very much at home in the peace and quiet of a prayerful environment. And my father, I think, had the ambition or hope for me that I would be a priest because in Catholic culture at that stage, this is pre-Vatican II. Vatican II took place 62 to 65. So we were talking, you know, middle 50s to early 60s. That than which nothing greater could be conceived for a Catholic family was to have a son who became a priest or a daughter who became a sister or a nun. So that was the dream that was held up for me. And I had internalized it. And I think that I saw myself going that way, although all along my father said, well, I want you to live a bit first. So I did. Finished high school, didn't go on to seminary, could have. Actually, out of eighth grade, the priest wanted to send me. Then out of high school, a father said, no, go to high school, play sports. I was a football and baseball player in college. And he said, live a bit. So I went and lived. And then the time came. I moved up to Cambridge after graduating from Princeton, started a master's and degree program at Harvard, met Jesuits, and in the context of the times and the people I had met, I decided to enter the Jesuit community. So here I was, finally fulfilling my father's dream. But the interesting thing was something I actually read about years later. I had not yet really become myself. I was living on the expectations of others, which many of us do.
Oh,
in the early
absolutely.
Part of our life. We live in the, you know, based
I
on
I was
the
one of those people.
Yeah, I bet. Mm-hmm. We were Nancy. And, so it took a time of turbulence inside of me, a time when I became depressed because there was something, it didn't quite feel right. I completed my theological studies in 1975 and was given the blessing to go ahead. You're worthy of ordination. But I took a leave of absence because I wasn't quite sure. I worked as a chaplain at a medical center in Boston. I was testing it out, seeing where I should go, and finally I moved on to my degree in Philadelphia and there decided, with the help of good Jesuit spiritual direction, that is, the men who encouraged me to really read myself and decide who was I, what was my true self, and I decided to leave. Now, the interesting thing, I'd left, I married, and I became a psychologist. And I still do many of the things, because I work with people on their interior lives even now, and a priest, in a sense, is that's what he does. So I found that my current state of life really allows me to integrate very important dimensions, my spirituality, my role as a psychologist, and, apropos of the book, my own aging at the moment. I'll be 70 this coming June.
My guest is Professor Robert Weber, and he is telling us his background. He wrote a book, The Spirituality of Age, A Seeker's Guide to Growing Older. He is co-author. And there's a scene in your book, Bob, that I thought, if you substitute Joe is the name of this mentor that you go in to talk to him, you're deciding you're going to leave the order. No, you have decided. I'll take that back. You have decided you're going to leave the order. And when you go in and you say hello and you chat a little bit, and then you got down to why you were your visit, and you told him that you were leaving the order. And then he began to ask you if you had considered this, if you considered that, if you really thought about this, prayed about this. And I just thought, if you substituted a doctor, sometimes a doctor, say somebody gets a diagnosis of cancer, and the doctor says, okay, here's this treatment, and there's going to be all these side effects. And if you decide, no, doctor, I don't think I want to do that, then they don't perhaps accept that. Because what you say in your book, you said, I made it clear I had not come to seek further direction. I'd come to say goodbye as a fellow Jesuit and then let him know how much affection, love, and gratitude I had for him because of the part he played in my growing into a man. We hugged and wept. And I thought that was such a poignant scene because there are a lot of times when we have to tell somebody of a decision we've made and they want to try to talk us out of it. And you realize that was the right decision for you. You say, my mind and heart were settled.
Yes. I was very much at peace at that juncture and very grateful to Joe and Bob, another Jesuit and spiritual director of mine. Joe was very instrumental in my early life as a Jesuit and had a profound impact helping me to cultivate a deeper sense of spirituality in the Jesuit tradition of St. Ignatius of Loyola. And, that is still with me. There's an old saying, Nancy, you can take the man out of the Jesuits, but you can't take the Jesuit out of the man. And that is the truth.
Well, I asked a friend who has a PhD in religious studies, and I asked her this question about Catholicism, and she said, you can't really leave, you can't really stop being a Catholic. It's like stop being Irish. And because I told her, I said, you probably get the question why you remain Catholic or why people remain Catholic. And that was her response to that. Now, when you went in to talk to Joe, he accepted your decision. But when you told your father, it wasn't that easy. He didn't react that way.
It was not. No, he did not. In fact, he reacted very strongly with, I would say, anger. that I had backed off from going ahead with the ordination. But what I didn't want to do, and I remember there was a fellow I really liked, an acquaintance more than a friend, though, a Jesuit, who went ahead and got ordained because everything had been lined up for him already, all the celebrations and the festivities. And he signed out of the Jesuits a week after his ordination. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to really step back and what the Jesuit term for it is discern, you know, really make a good decision. But my father... he was not happy. I had started dating my wife, now my wife, Pamela. And my father really liked Pamela. I mean, they got along, and Pamela could stand up to him as well as, you know, he respected her a great deal. And, you know, it took 3 years for my dad. But finally, one day he said, he looked at me with somewhat apologetically, although I wouldn't say it was an outright apology, he said, you know, Bob, all I've ever really wanted for you is your happiness.
Yeah.
And he could see that I was happy, that I had become my own man. You know, in a sense, there's a wonderful book, The Seasons of a Man's Life, by a man who was a psychologist at Yale University, Daniel Levinson. And he says that the first part of our life, from 19 to 28, this was in his longitudinal study, we really internalize all of another's expectations and we try to live that out. And then between 20 and 32, we hit rough going. Well, I was right on schedule. That's precisely when the bumps started. I hit the bumps in the road in my own path.
In fact, you refer to those as the boom years.
The boom years.
Becoming one's own man.
Exactly. And I had become myself. You know, and don't get me wrong. It's not a once and for all. I don't think any of us, whether it's a boom or a bow, you know, becoming one's own woman.
Mm-hmm.
It is an ongoing process, and I think that's why aging is so wonderful, because we have certain freedoms as we get older that perhaps we didn't have when we were 19 or 28 even, or 35 or 50. All of a sudden, we have a chance to say, now you're going to see who I really am, and I'm not afraid to be the true person who I am.
Yeah, for example, you say that you stood your ground when you told your dad that you're not going to become a priest, because a lot of parents would take that opportunity to make you feel guilty and
right.
make you feel ashamed. And yet you apparently did not fall for that.
I didn't. I think I didn't want to disappoint my dad. I really loved my father and very, very deeply. And he was a real, you know, a person I idealized. Now, I discovered through the years that, he, like all of us, he was not always good. He was sometimes bad and sometimes ugly. But I think he kind of has helped me to, as I've struggled and gradually come to accept him in his entirety. I've been able to come and accept myself in my entirety as a man who is a human being, a man who is good, who is bad at times, and who can be ugly at times. Just ask my wife. But I think that's what we are. That's the nature of the beast that I am, and we all are as human beings.
My guest is Robert Weber. He has a PhD in psychology, and he and his co-author have written The Spirituality of Age, A Seeker's Guide to Growing Older. And you mentioned when you were growing up as a child, and that's probably why, from a young age, you were comfortable with aging and with death.
Absolutely. We were not hidden from it. I'm really amazed when at Catholic burial services now even, you go, you're standing by the grave, and everybody walks away before the coffin is lowered. Often happens. I think that people are uncomfortable with the discomfort that occurs around grieving processes. I saw it at my father's funeral. When my uncle by marriage, he was married to my father's sister, came in, and my sister walked up to him. And you know what it's like at a funeral when you see somebody who's part of the memories, part of the family, and it touches you and evokes feelings. My sister started crying and ran up to my uncle and embraced him. And he, who was never comfortable with emotions, said, "Don't cry."
Mm.
And I looked at him and I said, "What are you supposed to do at a time like this but cry?" That is what one does at times like this. My father was a man who was able to shed tears. He could shed tears of sorrow. He could shed tears of joy. My mother did not wince in the face of life's realities. In fact, it was she who really helped me way back when I was about 11, somewhere between 7 and 11, I think more and more I realized I was 11 years old when I checked the historical facts, a television show, the old Lassie show, when Gramps' funeral occurs, completely surprised to me. I'm sitting there as an 11-year-old, and Gramps is being buried. Well, the actor, whom I didn't know that this had happened, but the actor George Cleveland had died in real life. I was shocked, and for the first time in my life at 11, despite the funerals I had been to for, you know, 5 and 6 years, the wake services I had been to in neighbors' homes where they were laid out in their parlor instead of the funeral home, I realized that my folks were going to die more profoundly than I ever had. And I got depressed, and I moped for several weeks, apparently. And my mother kept trying to draw me out of it. She kept saying, "What's wrong, Bobby?" And, you know, tough little boy, right? "Nothing. Nothing's wrong. Bobby, something's wrong." So finally she prevailed after about 2 weeks or so. And I sat down, and she said, "What's the matter? You got to tell me." And I looked her in the eye, burst into tears, sobbing. And I said, "Mom, you're going to die. You and Dad are going to die." You know, how would you as a parent respond to that if your kid said that to you? Well, my mom, I think, showed her wisdom and her life experience. She looked at me and put her hand on my shoulder, and she said, "Bobby, that's true. I am going to die someday." And I thought, oh, my God, I was right. But then she said, "You know, probably not for a while." She was right about that. It was about 39 years later that she died. And then she added, "So in the meantime, go out and play with your friends." And I've been doing that ever since. Because all we got is the time we got now, between now and then. And I'm going to get there as my mother and father did, as every last one of us will. But in the meantime, I am going to live and play with my friends.
Well, I mentioned that your book is arranged in the form of questions. You and your co-author selected 25 questions. And each of you answers these questions, and I hesitate to use even the word answer, because you're not saying this is the answer, but you and your co-author, Carol Orsborn, happens to have been raised Jewish, and so you bring your perspective. Now that I think it's helpful for listeners to know what your own background is as you answer these key questions. For example, early in the book, you deal with the question, what is the relationship between spirituality and religion? And in that section is where you answer the question why you remain Catholic.
Yes.
And this relationship between spirituality and religion is comes up a lot now, more so than when I was growing up, because when I was growing up, people belonged to some church, religion, and young people now, if you ask them, they say, "Well, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious." Mm-hmm. And that, how do you answer people who, or how do you respond? Because your co-author, Carol Orsborn, says, at their best, there is no difference. Mm-hmm. And I like that answer.
Yes. I think one thing we need to realize is that for many people, the way religion is practiced in a given community or congregation or temple or mosque even, you know, sometimes what's the way it is given expression through the rite, the ritual, the beliefs, you know, people go, "That's just not speaking deeply enough to me." I know I've been to churches where the sermons were just, did not take me any deeper into prayer, into myself, or deeper into my relationship with God. And I'm a God-centered person. And what I think is that a Jesuit writer named Anthony DeMello, who died in 1987, I guess, a young man, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant person, and an Indian Jesuit, wrote that, you know, he said, spirituality are these things. And at the end, he adds, he goes through a number of points, but he says at the end, and religion is intended to lead you there. The rite, the rituals, the belief, and the community are supposed to sustain and help one's spirituality to flourish. And if it's done well with good, you know, a good rabbi, a good minister, a good priest, a good imam, then it will cultivate that which is at the heart of religion, which is a deeper spirituality. That doesn't always happen, sadly. But that also is life.
Well, what people who claim not to be religious but spiritual can't understand how somebody like you, an educated person, continues to follow a religion that seems to require childish submission to an institution, the church, and professes to believe in a story that seems like a fairy tale, that practices rituals that seem ridiculous to them, and that offers a community of people that are so different than somebody like you. So how do you respond?
Well, let me give you an example, Nancy. We have a group therapy society here in the Boston area, Northeast, actually. We're affiliated with the American Group Psychotherapy Association, and every year we have a conference in Boston. And one year I submitted a proposal to do the special event at the end of the conference, which was to demonstrate how you do a group where you integrate psychology and spirituality. Now, I'm part of a reading group, and one of the colleagues and friends who's a member of that reading group is Jewish. And he got on my case about this. He said, what are you going to bring that crap to the conference for? You know, he really gave me a lot of flack about it. And he was, part of it was horsing around, but also he was serious. And I just said, I need to because this is what matters to me. Well, he came to the conference, of course, and I did my piece. It was a three-hour event. I did a demonstration group with some volunteers. We had an initial presentation on to frame the process we were going to go through. Then we did the group, and then we had respondents and discussion afterwards. And he was one of the people posing questions from the audience, and they were hard questions, and with a certain edge to them. Well, at the next reading meeting that we had, we meet monthly, he said to me, Bob, thank you. I said, for what? He said, for doing what you did. I said, what's that? He said, for doing that event at our conference. And I said, oh, okay, well, you're welcome. He said, I want you to know something. He said, you know, I said I was an atheist. I guess I realize now I'm really more of an agnostic. That was not my intention. You know, I didn't do that because I was trying to get anybody to change his or her mind about religion or spirituality. I did that because it bespeaks who I am, and I need to put it out there, and I'm willing to live with whatever diatribes are thrown at me. At one recent meet and greet at a bookstore in the Boston area, this guy comes up and says, how could anybody be so stupid to write a book about those kind of topics? And I looked at him, and I said, that's an interesting question. I said, can you tell me more about why you're questioning me that way? And he goes on. We had about a wonderful 20-minute conversation. Neither of us, you know, moving the other any which way, but we got to talk.
Well, you know,
that's
converse. Well, there are a lot of things going on in the Catholic Church that are not desirable, if that's the word I want to use. And
very undesirable.
Yeah, and you say even your wife can't understand how you can put up with some of that, the problems and scandals. But I also hear a lot of non-Catholics say they are so happy to have Pope Francis at the head of the Catholic Church. Even non-Catholics love this guy. And yep. You say in your book, you say, these days I'm further bolstered by the advent of the Church's new leader, Pope Francis.
Right. Yeah. Right. I think, you know, Francis was a Jesuit. Officially, you have to sort of step out of the order when you move on to a post like the Pope. But when he was provincial in Argentina, he was often not a very nice guy. He was very authoritarian. He divided people in the province by his stances. But what I respect about him is I think he learned through the way, you know, learned to move beyond the way he was, and I think has become more who he really is.
Yeah, which is what we all hope to do.
That's what we all hope to do. I mean, the fact that he could, you know, not do the traditional washing of the feet on Holy Thursday, but go to a prison or a setting where people are incarcerated and wash the feet of many different people, men and women, not just men, and washing the feet of people who are not even Catholic, you know, that he could do this. And then they ask him about, you know, the question of homosexuality. He says, who am I to judge?
Yeah.
And then he takes a man who's got all this, like, fibromatosis all over his body and embraces him in public. His year of mercy, the year he declared this to be, I think bespeaks the kind of man he is.
My guest is psychotherapist and professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School, Robert Weber. And we're talking about his book, The Spirituality of Age, A Seeker's Guide to Growing Older. And the book contains 25 questions to guide as you pose, you and your co-author, Carol Orsborn, pose these 25 questions. And we mentioned one of them is, what is the relationship between spirituality and religion? And then you have the question, what is spiritual awakening? And you've mentioned your wife a couple of times. And in the section, what wakes you up? I want to ask you about that.
She wakes me up.
We are going to take a little break. And I want to ask you about your wife when we get back.
Fine.
My guest is Robert Weber of Harvard Medical School. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. I'm Nancy Wiegman. We're back with my guest, Robert Weber, who's a psychotherapist and author of The Spirituality of Age, A Seeker's Guide to Growing Older. And I might add to that, besides being a psychologist, you were a football player at Princeton, and not just a bench warmer.
Not just a bench warmer. No.
In fact, was there a Bobby Weber Day at Princeton?
There was. My hometown was located about 16 miles from Princeton, and Princeton and my hometown were such different worlds. My hometown is Manville, New Jersey, otherwise known as the Asbestos City. We have the largest asbestos production plant in the world. And in fact, our football field, if you can believe this, was built on the refuse of the plant. You know, and I don't know how much asbestos was in the ground, but we played football there. Well, I still haven't gotten mesothelioma or asbestosis, but our town was enthusiastic about football. We had not been a very good team for the years. Our high school was founded in 1959, and the first couple of years it was pretty bad. And then as a freshman, I got to start as a quarterback for the varsity, which scared the heck out of me because I was 130 pounds or something, and you know, I was running against these 180, 195-pound seniors. But our town was so enthusiastic, and then I did very well at football and baseball and played basketball as well. And, you know, fortunately, that led to my being recruited by schools, not only for my football, but I was valedictorian in my class. And, and I chose Princeton finally. Got there, different world. You know, guys from prep school, guys, you know, who were going to debutante coming out balls. I didn't, what is that? I said to myself. But when I got there, I think I settled in. And again, at football, I had my bumps and grinds. It wasn't a smooth ride. I had my injuries. I had frustration. I was sidelined, if not bench warming, I was bench warming as a sideline person with injury. And then I did very well in my senior year, but got injured again. But had done well enough to get some accolades. And then the last game of the year, my hometown bust people down for a Bobby Weber Day at the stadium, which was quite moving. But again, I felt that my success was because of the people who had supported and sustained me, family first and foremost, friends, and my community. And I'm grateful for them.
Well, now, I did say before the break that I was going to ask you about your wife because
Let's not forget Pamela.
You and your co-author posed that question, what wakes you up? And you mentioned your wife. And how does she wake you up?
Well, let me add a little preface here, Nancy. She wakes me up. Remember, you had said earlier in the first part of our conversation that, she was raised Catholic, but no longer, goes to church with me. And, I've grown to know that that's okay because I find her, she lives what I profess to live at a much deeper level at times than I myself do. She gave it a good shot. When we got married, we went to church together for about 5 years, and then we began to hit some churches that were really not encouraging of growth. and that dissuaded her. I brought enough to the services that I got something from them, but she didn't have the same internalized, if you want to say, resources from my time as a Jesuit and my time growing up in my town of Manville. She didn't have those. But nonetheless, she is the most loving and remarkably kind person. Tough as nails, too, at times. In fact, in the car.
Well, you say that you didn't know how much your life partner would awaken me to truths about myself
that were
never fully revealed, even during your time as a Jesuit. And you do give the example of when you're riding in the car, you kind of have a temper, Bob.
I have a temper. But, you know, it's interesting to look beyond just the manifestation. But, you know, we can stop with the temper, the angry moment. But what my wife gets me to is realize how much that's connected with my pride and narcissism. You know, that somebody would cut me off, as she puts it, if they only knew it was Bobby Weber. They would not have done that. And it's like, got me. Because really, you know, the pridefulness, I think, is something that I have had to come to terms with.
Well, and she does it with humor. That's what, you got to give her credit for that, too.
She does it with humor, hard-hitting, but palatable. You know, I can take it because she really delivers it in a way that gets me to be able to own it. She doesn't get me to become more defensive or resist her comments. And I have had to allow that to meld into my own experience so I can try to change myself. Have I changed completely? No. Does she still call me on it? Yes. But I think I am better. Thanks to her.
Yeah.
She also taught me about love.
Mm-hmm.
Very important. You know, we're scared of love, Nancy, most of us.
Well, and
I dare say all of us are to some extent.
And you say that probably the most important thing that she has awakened you to is the meaning of love as an act of surrender to another. And I noticed in your book how often the word surrender comes up, because that's something that I feel we're always fighting this. We use the term fight. We fight this, we fight that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, where is the word surrender in our conversations? And you say that the meaning of love as an act of surrender to another, not just a submissive resignation.
Right, right. And believe me, growing up, I learned to do for myself. I was very independent, very able to take care of myself. Even in my family, I was out there studying, you know, working, doing all the things that were called for. I was a good boy, you know, a good boy, and one who wanted to live up to the standards. But little by little, I think I started realizing that wasn't the way to live. That wasn't the way to live. That I had to change. I'm getting a little off course here. Could you redirect me a bit?
Well, you say that Pamela wakes me up to the importance of letting go.
Yes.
Letting go of the many things I hold, possessions, attitudes, bad habits, obsession, but would in fact have a more powerful hold on me. These things, events, and people restrict my freedom
right. And
extract an exorbitant price in terms of my time, my health, my well-being, physically and spiritually. And that, I think, is a wonderful gift. She wakes you up to the importance of letting go.
Yes.
And because I think people don't realize we pay a high price of holding on.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, really do. In fact, you know, one of our endorsers, Gail Sheehy, who her newest book is called Daring, mm-hmm. My Passages, and she wrote Passages. I met Gail actually back in late 70s when she was at an event that I was at. I didn't know who she was even at the time, but I got put in a small group with her, and it was a wonderful experience to do this weekend being in a small group with her and one other woman. But she says in her endorsement, are you a boomer on a white-knuckled ride trying to shift into reverse on aging? We all try. This knowing book will relax your grip. And that is what you're saying. That's what Pamela says. Let go.
Yeah.
You know, when you find yourself in times of trouble, Mother Mary calls to you, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it go.
Yeah.
You know, the Beatles nailed it in that song, too. You know, it's about being able to let go. I mean, when we try to control life, we cannot. We cannot.
Well, that's one of the things we learn as we go, I think. It takes us a while to learn that, but I think we do learn it.
And what happens, you know, is one of the things that imprisons us are the illusions we allow ourselves to be taken over by. Now, some illusions for a time are good, like falling in love. That's an illusion. Love is a child of illusion and the parent of disillusion. It's what happens when the disillusionment sets in.
And what you're quoting Unamuno now.
Unamuno. And then when you become older, you have to confront the shattering of three grand delusions that preoccupy, unconsciously, us, I think, throughout our lives, especially in American culture. One is that we are immortal. I mean, when I was a football player, I thought, I'm immortal. I also thought I was invulnerable until I started getting injured. In the last 2 years, I've had a torn rotator cuff in four places. I've had carpal tunnel issues, and now I've got hip problems. I'm no longer able to say you're invulnerable. And the third is I'm more dependent. I'm no longer completely independent. You know, that's the American way, right? Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Be independent. But what happens when you realize you're mortal, vulnerable, and dependent? Does it cause you to lose face in your own eyes? Or does it help you to grow as it has me? Because of the illusions being shattered, I think three points of growth have occurred. One, insofar as dependency, I think I'm now much more appreciative of how important community is to me, and always has been, though I had denied it. How my vulnerability, experiencing my own vulnerability, has enabled me to experience greater compassion for others. Whereas previously I might have looked askance at somebody who was, you know, limping along. And mortality, what can you get from that? What I've gotten from that, and it's a funny way to put it, but I've gotten a great sense of comfort. I feel very relaxed in the face of death. Perhaps part of it is that gift my mother gave me when I was 11 years old that's now being fruitful in very different ways. But I feel very, very, very comforted, even in the face of my mortality.
My guest is Robert Weber, and he has written a book, The Spirituality of Age, A Seeker's Guide to Growing Older. His co-author is Carol Orsborn. And Bob, there's something that, well, not just Carol mentions, but she brings up the point that we live our lives as if they were a journey. Mm-hmm. But she says our journey is a pilgrimage. And that really, I know how true that is because I am a pilgrim. In fact, I have a certificate proving that I'm a mm-hmm. pilgrim, that I walked the Camino de Santiago in Spain. And I understood exactly what she was meaning. I'm not a hiker, I'm not a backpacker, but I am a pilgrim. Yes. And you says, you also, there's another author that you and Carol like, Jane Marie Thibault.
Oh, yes.
And you say that she also suggests that we think of our lives not as a journey, but as a pilgrimage.
A pilgrimage.
Mature spirituality is not just about smelling the roses on an endless path. And when you walk a pilgrimage like that, you don't know where you're going to put your head that night. There's so many unknowns. You're happy if you find a dry, warm place to spend the night. And you don't know what that day will bring. And you quote Jane Marie Thibault, how can we experience aging as pilgrimage? By envisioning the things that occur in later life, not as a random series of sometimes positive, but often negative events that we have to be, that have to be suffered, endured, or adapted to, but as an intentional embracing of all experiences in a movement toward wisdom, one's true self, ultimate reality, meaning God, and one's death as final fulfillment. Mm-hmm. And you have been mentioning this, too. You said the only way to transform the journey into a pilgrimage is to relinquish control.
Right.
And that's what you've been saying, that you say once you stopped struggling so hard for explanation, blame, or meaning is when you you grew spiritually.
Exactly. You know, I learned that in my work as a psychotherapist, too, that in the beginning, I thought it was all about being, you know, omnipotent, omniscient, and totally benevolent all the time, you know, and being able to fix people. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, care is more than cure. And I think what's happened is I've let go there, too. Now I see myself as, not omnipotent, omniscient, or totally benevolent. Sometimes somebody rubs me the wrong way, and I have to learn how to deal with that and use it for therapeutic purposes. Sometimes I don't know what they're saying. I don't have a crystal ball or a capacity to read their mind and absolutely know what they're saying. And you know, I may not have the power to change the course of their lives. In fact, I don't have it. When I relax in that setting, then I can be of use to people. I think what we do in the book, Nancy, is I think we've relaxed our grip so that we can be of some use. We're not telling you, follow us. We know the way. This is the way to do it. Do it this way, and you're going to get there. No, we're saying, look, here are two more pilgrims. struggling with the questions.
In fact, I do want to mention that you have an appendix, 12 exercises and for seekers. One of the 12 exercises, you suggest take your question for a walk.
Yes.
And that's what, when you're a pilgrim, when you're walking, literally, this pilgrimage in Spain, across France and Spain, actually, that's what you're doing. You're walking, and you say that's one of the exercises that you suggest in your appendix. Take your question for a walk in nature. It's not simply a hike or a stroll, but it's a spiritual exercise. And you'll find yourself accessing sources of wisdom that affirm, reveal, and deepen your relationship to the sacred. And so many people walk this who, I think maybe they aren't even necessarily spiritual, that spiritual when they start the pilgrimage, but it's transforming. And that's what you suggest in your book, to let the journey be transformed into a pilgrimage. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Professor, about your book.
Well, yeah, and a delight to be here. I really enjoyed the conversation. And, you know, you mentioned the exercises. I think if people want to get a flavor of the book, we have a book website, and people can go in and get a real feel for the book. There are excerpts. There are, you know, some of the exercises are there. The endorsers commented there. Other material, even interviews we've had, people can go and listen to other things or read other things. And that's www.spiritualityofage.com.
Well, I know you've got to run because you have a patient to see.
I do. And I'm going to try not to be omnipotent, omniscient, and totally benevolent.
Wonderful. And have a sense of humor. It's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Great talking to you, Nancy. Thank you.
My guest has been Robert Weber. His book is The Spirituality of Age, A Seeker's Guide to Growing Older. For most of his life, Sir Ken Robinson lived and worked in England. He was knighted by Queen Elizabeth for his achievements leading a British advisory committee on creative education. In 2001, he moved to the United States. His 2006 TED Talk on the importance of creativity in schools is the most watched talk in TED history. He said, "In failing to recognize creativity, our schools are failing to prepare the next generation for the challenges that lie ahead." He is also author of best-selling books on creativity. His most recent book is Creative Schools, The Grassroots Revolution That's Transforming Education. Sir Ken Robinson was recently at Lackson Auditorium in Chico as a part of the President's Lecture Series at Chico State University, urging schools and colleges everywhere to rethink their basic assumptions about intelligence and achievement. Welcome to Chico, Sir Ken Robinson. I read in your book, sometimes people say they agree with me, but probably wouldn't if they understood what I was really saying. So I want to know, what are you really saying? In your book, for example, you talk about creativity, you cover a lot of topics, and what is it that people don't understand that you say?
Well, thank you again for the invitation. It's great to be in Chico. I don't mean that everybody would disagree with me if they knew what I was saying.
But because I was reading along thinking, yes, 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 he's so right, I agree so much. And then I come across this and it's, oh, maybe I don't understand.
What I mean is that sometimes I hear people who I know are doing things that I'm critical of in the book and in the work I do, who are allegedly agreeing with my approach, but they're doing something quite different. And, you know, for example, they, I think, sometimes assume that that what I'm arguing for is something that's opposed to traditional academic standards. There's a long-standing debate in education between so-called traditional teaching and progressive teaching. And some people, I think, believe that I'm wholly on the side of some open form of what they think of as progressive education and entirely critical of kids learning information or developing practical skills. And I'm absolutely not. They think sometimes I'm wholly critical of people going to university. And I'm not. I think it's actually the right course for some people. And I suppose the risk is that when people hear you talk about creativity, it's a bit like apple pie. You know, they assume it's just a good thing. But if they're to really penetrate more, and again, I'm not about everybody, I'm just saying some people, if they penetrate more deeply into the argument, they might find it more complex and challenging than they think. Because what I'm arguing for is really quite a radical shift in how we think of schools, how we think of teaching, and what we think of as the purpose of education. I'm not just arguing for another way of doing what we always did. I'm arguing that we should do something else.
And so you have to think about that. What is the purpose of education?
You know,
we think we know.
Well, that's part of the problem. It's one of those words. There's a philosopher called Walter Bryce Galley there was. And he came up with this conception of what he called essentially contested concepts. It's an interesting idea. What he means is that there are some words that at face value we all think we understand and agree with, but then we end up having fierce arguments about them because it turns out we have quite different conceptions of what they really do mean. One of them is democracy. People argue a lot about democracy, like do they mean democracy for everybody? Do they mean everybody should vote and have equal rights to vote? Do we mean that there should be proportional representation? When you dig down into the idea of democracy, people end up meaning quite different things by it. Freedom is a good one. You know, I live in America now, so I hope people will understand I'm not being critical of this as an outsider. But
in fact, you are a resident alien.
I'm a resident alien. I delight in the title of a resident alien and will apply for citizenship in due course. But you know, here's a country founded on the principle of freedom and the pursuit of happiness, and yet one that was also grounded in slavery. So it wasn't freedom for everybody, it was freedom for some people. And even some of the founding fathers saw no contradiction in that. So that there are some terms which are at face value agreeable to everybody, but when you start to dig into them, it turns out people have very different conceptions of them and will fight for their alternative understanding. And education, I'm saying, is a bit like that. It's one of those ideas that superficially people think they all agree on, but it turns out we mean quite different things by it. For some people, education is only and only about getting kids ready for the job market. For others, it has nothing at all to do with that. And people will come to blows, metaphorically, sometimes actually, for their view of education, particularly if they haven't decided in advance to set out what they really do mean. So in the book I just published called Creative Schools, I start out by saying that I ought to lay my stall out here. And one of my points is that education should have a dual focus, that we all live in a world that was here before we got here. There's a world around us, and education should help our children to understand that. The way cultures have been formed, the history, the achievements that people have contributed to the canon of human culture. But there's a world that only exists because they exist, and so education, in my view, should also help them understand that world, the inner world and the outer world. But it comes down as well to four quite specific objectives. There are economic purposes in education, there are cultural purposes, there are social purposes, and there are personal purposes. And just to take the social for a moment, we live in one of the world's most celebrated democracies, but it's also a country now in which relatively few people who can vote do vote. Something that John Dewey once said is that democracy has to be rediscovered by every generation. Democracy is not an entitlement, it's a practice. And if people don't participate, if they don't understand how it works, if they don't challenge things they think are wrong, democracy starts to falter. So one of the roles of education in a democratic society is to help people understand how the society works and what their roles can be in it and how they can participate and challenge it if they think there's a sound reasons for doing that. Well, you don't do that by just having civics courses once a month. You do it by running schools in such a way that kids actually practice these principles and live them and understand how they work and why they matter. So if you see, if you were to agree that there are these four big purposes, it leads you in a particular direction for education. If you think it's only about the economy, you go in a different direction.
One of your chapters in your book, Creative Schools, is entitled Chapter 6, What's Worth Knowing? And I spent years as a teacher. I had university students, and I was always asking myself that too, in my subject, what's worth knowing? So how do we decide what's worth knowing?
Well, one of the reasons for asking the question is because it is so fundamental. There's been a huge debate around, in America, for example, around the Common Core, where there's been an attempt to set out very specific areas of knowledge and understanding in mathematics and languages, and it's caused all kinds of furore. Some people see this as government overreach, as political manipulation. One of the most fierce debates inside of education has been around the work of people like E.D. Hirsch, who set out a whole taxonomy of cultural ideas he thought every child should be taught in school. And some people take great exceptions to that. They think, well, if you're arguing for these writers, why not those writers? And if you're arguing for male artists, why not these female artists? And if you're arguing for this culture, why not that culture? So as soon as you get closer, it starts to become very, very complex as an idea. And people have different faith traditions. So they think those things should be taught in school. So I'm not backing away from the question. I'm not trying to resolve it either. But the thing I am trying to say in the book is that in practice, in the years since No Child Left Behind became the law of the land and all the testing that's become associated with it, the curriculum in schools has narrowed in very many cases in a way that's harming our children's balanced education. And the reason is that only certain parts of the curriculum are being tested and they've become associated with the success or failure of the school and the school system itself. So, for example, there's a big emphasis on mathematics and languages, and good, there should be. And on the sciences, yes, they're very important too. Now there's this expression of STEM disciplines, science, technology, engineering, and math. But along the way, in California this being the case, arts programs, for example, have been cut across the state. Arts teachers have lost their jobs. There was a report several years back by Quadrant Research, a wonderful guy called Bob Morrison who runs it, into music education in California and the devastation of music programs and loss of music teachers since No Child Left Behind. The report was called The Sound of Silence. It's very important we have humanities programs in schools. If you agree with these four purposes, you can't say, well, they're the right purposes, but let's just have STEM disciplines. You need a curriculum which includes the arts and the sciences, humanities, and you need a curriculum that includes languages and physical education. You know, more and more kids are being disengaged from schools, more and more teachers are being disaffected from education, and more kids are being medicated to stay with the program. And this is at a time when we're cutting recess, we're cutting back on physical education, and we're sitting kids down to do remorseless tests every week. So the problem lies in the system. So the point of the chapter is to argue for breadth as well as for depth, and to say that if we're to meet these four purposes, then we should give equal weight to the arts, the sciences, humanities, physical education, maths and science, for cultural and economic reasons, but also because for some kids that's where their real strengths are. And if we deprive them of access to their own talents, then we're doing them a terrible disservice. We create a whole kind of outer ring of kids who are thought to be less smart, less educable. And it turns out very often these kids who drop out of school are perfectly educable if we adjust the curriculum and re-embrace their particular talents and strengths. So we need breadth for that reason too.
Well, you had mentioned Dr. Maria Montessori. You have a quote in her book. Because some of these ideas that you present are not unheard of. Maria Montessori says, the teacher shall observe whether the child interests himself, how he interests himself, for how long, even noticing the expression on his face. And I was thinking, now there's a doctor I'd like to go to. If she's looking at me and watching and watching my face, then she's a doctor I'd like to go to. And that's what you encourage in your book, that we should not put everybody in the same mold.
Well, a big part of this for me, it's just exactly that. I say in the book, I'm not claiming some copyright on all these ideas. On the contrary, I'm just trying to provide another platform for them. There have been people since the dawn of education, and particularly since the development of public education, who've been arguing for these exact things, and running schools based on these principles with tremendous success. The problem is to get them into the mainstream of education, and to get our policymakers to understand why they matter so much, and that you can't really improve education by remote control. As soon as you start to treat it in the same category as manufacturing motor cars or improving flow through an oil pipe, as soon as you start to see it as an impersonal industrial process that can be improved if you just keep raising standards and testing, you lose sight of how it works. It's a human process. Kids in school are no different from you and me, and from their own parents. They're living, breathing people with ideas and feelings and motivations and biographies and circumstances, and they flourish under certain conditions and they wilt under other sorts of conditions, just like we did. And if you get a teacher who does look into your eyes and sees what you're capable of and encourages you, that's when you're more likely to rise to the challenge and do your best and become your best. And if you have a system of education that hobbles that process by discouraging kids and by demoralizing teachers, you can't expect it to perform at its peak. And we've had over 15 years of this approach, and it spectacularly hasn't worked. So I think it's time to try something else. And the good news is we know what something else looks like, but we just need the courage to implement it now.
Well, you also discuss the history in your book briefly of where we got this system, how from the 19th century, and what its purpose was then.
Yes, I mean, it's always worth remembering that the systems of mass education, mass publicly funded education, are relatively recent inventions. They weren't around much before the middle of the 19th century. Anywhere, there are a few outcrops, but not in America, not in most of Europe. And they developed within the context of the Industrial Revolution, and they are modelled in some ways on the principles of industrial production. Schools, in lots of respects, are modelled on the same principles of mass production that many factories are. I don't mean to overcall the metaphor, but you know, they run from 9 to 5, bells ring, people shuffle around the building in in groups. They go from lesson to lesson, subject to subject. They get tested periodically. And there's a sense that from the beginning of what sort of product we're trying to produce. And we have a lot of waste products and a lot of byproducts. And it's partly because of the organizational culture. It creates the problems that we think we're trying to solve. And part of the message in the book for me is it's not just addressed to politicians. In fact, not at all. It's addressed to parents and teachers and kids. But I do get to work a lot with policymakers, and some of them are great and some frankly aren't. They don't understand how this works, and any more than often people who are put in charge of the health service understand anything about patient-doctor dynamics. And there are similar problems in the health systems as well, by the way. But part of the issue, part of the point I'm trying to make is that many of these problems are caused by the system. They're manufactured by the system. And so when politicians say to me, how can we solve these problems of disengagement, low morale and low graduation rates, part of my answer is stop causing them. Yeah. Do something else and see if you get a better result, because you will. As I think I said somewhere, if your shoe hurts, don't polish it, change it.
You mentioned bells, and you describe in your book a school that did not use bells, and it was project-based learning, a school that didn't have bells.
Yeah.
And project-based learning sounds like that would really grab the students and get their attention and get them excited about learning.
Well, yes, I mean, it's not a new idea at all. It's been around forever. And my early work in education was particularly in the area of the applications of theatre and drama practices in schools. And, some people thought, well, this is terribly frivolous, but it actually is not. Children, young people of all ages, learn as much from each other as from anybody else. Great students are also teachers. Great teachers are also students. And among the things we want from education is for our kids to develop their powers of creativity, self-confidence, a sense of direction and purpose. At the moment we have something like in the US, it's always hard to be specific because of differences in definition, but according to the official figures, something like 7,000 kids a day leave high school before they graduate. I'm trying to avoid the term dropout. I don't like it. Because it sounds like the system failed, like they failed the system. I think it's more appropriate to say with those numbers that the system failed them. It's something like 30% in some areas. It's higher, actually, in some parts of the country. Well, it's not because they don't want to learn. It's not because they want a life that doesn't add up to anything. It's because the system doesn't engage them. And for a lot of people, sitting at desks all day, doing paperwork and shuffling papers around and doing what they might consider to be pointless clerical exercises is not the way to engage them. But the book is full of examples of this. If you get kids on their feet, get them working together, give them real problems to solve, real world problems for them to explore and that excite their curiosity and deepen their need for knowledge, understanding and discipline, it's absolutely transformative. So that's my point. If having a more creative approach to education isn't a problem, it's a solution.
Well, give us the title of your book again, the whole title, Creative Schools.
The Grassroots Revolution That's Transforming Education.
Creative Schools, the Grassroots Revolution That's Transforming Education. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Sir Ken Robinson.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
I'd also like to thank my first guest, Robert Weber, a professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School, who has written The Spirituality of Age, A Compassionate Guide for Transforming Aging into Spiritual Growth. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynsbr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.